This is Solve It for Kids.
Hello, my amazing and curious friends. My name is Jennifer, and this is Solve It for Kids, the podcast that gives kids and families a peek inside the real world of scientists, engineers, and experts as they solve problems in their jobs using creativity, cooperation, and critical thinking. And now please welcome to the show my podcast partner, Galactic Space Geek, Jeff Gagne.
Hello, Jennifer, and hello, listeners. Yes, Jennifer and Jeff's holiday break is still going on, and we hope you're enjoying yours. Galactic Space Geek Jeff is super excited to share today's episode with you.
The best of deep space.
Oh, now I know why Jeff is so excited. It is the best of deep space. And you are all going to have fun listening to How Do You Have a Snowball Fight on Mars? With author Suzanne Slate. How do scientists listen to black holes?
So cool.
With LIGO scientist Dr. Eric Thrain. And finally, what do you need to know to operate a rover on Mars?
Who doesn't want to know that?
Right. And that one's with JPL engineer Brian Franz. We hope you enjoy them all.
How do you have a snowball fight on Mars?
That sounds like the coolest thing ever. Who's our guest that's going to tell us all about this?
So the person that knows all about snowball fighting on Mars is Miss Suzanne Slade. She is both a mechanical engineer and a children's author. And she wrote a book all about Mars.
Yes, and Suzanne's been on the show, so we are so excited to welcome you back. Welcome to the show, Suzanne.
Well, thank you, Jen and Jeff. I am so excited to be on Solve It for Kids.
Yes, and we're excited to have you back because your first episode, which was, how to build a rocket without blowing it up, is a huge success. Lots of people have listened to that one.
Well, I'm happy they're enjoying it.
And now we get to take it a little bit further. A lot of that episode was rockets to get astronauts to the moon. And now we get to talk all the way out to Mars.
Yes, exciting. All right. And now, so tell us a little bit about Mars. Like, how did you come to know anything about Mars? And I guess everything you've learned about Mars.
Well, I'll tell you, Jen, this project for my new book, which is called Mars Is, it started when I was in a bookstore, because where do you discover cool stuff but in a bookstore?
True.
And there I saw a book on the cover that had a picture of Mars. I opened it up and it had the most phenomenal, amazing photos of Mars I've ever seen. They totally blew me away. I'd never seen anything like it. And I noticed that they were taken by HiRISE, a camera called HiRISE, which is an acronym that stands for High Resolution Imaging Science Equipment. Excuse me, experiment. I always get that wrong. But what that means is HiRISE is the most powerful camera ever sent to another planet. And right now, at this moment, HiRISE is orbiting Mars about 200 miles from its surface, taking more photos of Mars. It's been doing this for 15 years. It's taken over 69,000 photos of Mars.
Wow.
And what's so amazing is they're very detailed. And the scientists who created this camera, they then color enhance the photos in a very special way that allows scientists to see details their eyes could never detect without this color enhancement. And they can figure out the types of minerals or rocks they're looking at. They look at canyons and craters and volcanoes, even snow and ice on Mars.
Wow.
It sounds like this camera is the answer to every time I've been asked, why are humans trying to go to Mars?
Exactly.
It sounds like an awesome place.
It is an awesome place. And it has wind, clouds, and weather and seasons, just like Earth. Only it's a lot colder than Earth. The average temperature on Mars on an average day is minus 80 degrees Fahrenheit.
That's on a good day? Does it get colder than that?
That's an average. Okay, so it'll vary. The coldest it can get at Mars at night is minus 190 degrees Fahrenheit. That's a
yikes.
And the highest temperature during the day is 86 degrees Fahrenheit. But that average is that minus 80 I was talking about.
But you have to have equipment to be on Mars. Like humans can't breathe on Mars, correct?
Correct, right. The atmosphere around Mars is mostly CO2, carbon dioxide. And, you know, our lungs like oxygen. So, no, you couldn't be on Mars without special equipment so that you could breathe and the temperatures would be regulated for the human body.
So our question for you today, Suzanne, was, how do you have a snowball fight on Mars? Has this high-rise camera taken photos of snow on Mars?
It sure has. So what you have on Mars is a north and south pole, kind of like the poles we have on Earth. And those poles are covered with a crust of frozen carbon dioxide ice. But below that carbon dioxide layer is actually frozen snow and ice made of water, H2O snow and ice like we have on Earth. And if you go a little bit away from the poles, more towards the center of Mars, now you're not at the equator yet, you're not in the middle, but if you move kind of halfway between-ish, not too far below the surface, or what they call the subsurface, a couple centimeters to 1 or 2 meters, is more ice and snow made of water. So what happens is when you want to have that snowball fight on Mars, you're going to look around and see if a meteor has recently come in and crashed into Mars. Okay,
when does that happen a lot? The meteors crash there?
It does happen a lot.
Oh my gosh.
So when that happens, right, that throws all the material out. It creates what's called an impact crater from the impact of the meteor. And then at the bottom of that, and HiRISE has photographed this, is a little white dot, and that is snow and ice. So you're going to run down in that crater, you're going to grab that snow and ice, and you're going to have that snowball fight.
How do scientists listen to black holes?
Oh, now I understand. How do scientists listen to black holes? This is going to be fabulous. Who is our guest, Jeff?
That is right. How you listen to black holes. You heard that right, everybody. And today we are going to be talking with Dr. Eric Thrain, astrophysicist, university professor, and gravitational wave scientist, who is going to tell us about one of the most amazing discoveries that has happened in the last 100 years in science.
Ooh, welcome to the show, Dr. Eric.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I think this is one of our coolest episodes and we haven't even started. So you work with gravitational waves. So the big question is, what are gravitational waves?
Indeed. So it all begins with Einstein's theory of gravity, which is called general relativity. And according to Einstein, space and time are combined into something called space-time. And you can visualize it like a rubber sheet. That rubber sheet has things like planets and stars on it. And when you put them on the sheet warps, it sags.
Sure.
And that warping is the presence of gravity. That's what the force of gravity is. It is essentially the warping of space-time. So for example, if you want to think about the motion of the moon around the Earth, imagine putting a bowling ball on a rubber sheet. The bowling ball is the Earth. It causes the sheet to sag. And then you take a little marble that represents the moon and you roll it on this sagging rubber sheet. And it will go in a little circle around the bowling ball representing the Earth. That's the picture that Einstein gave us of how gravity works. And the rubber sheet, that's the warped space-time. And gravity, according to Einstein, is just the motion of these marbles and balls, planets and stars, on a warped sheet of space-time. So far, so good?
That's the coolest. I know, right? That's the coolest explanation. Now I understand. That's so cool.
All right, but we got to work up to
the rubber sheet made it much more understandable.
Yes.
Cool. So this is the picture we've had of how gravity works for about 100 years. And once you have this picture of general relativity in your mind, there are some pretty weird consequences. One consequence is that you can get holes in your fabric sheet. You can get punctures. So if someone comes by and they put a really, really big bowling ball on your stretchy sheet and they pile mass onto it and make it bigger and bigger, what will happen? The sheet will sag more and more, right?
Yes.
Right.
Eventually, if that sheet sags too much, it will get a hole in it, a puncture, a rip in the fabric of space-time. And that rip, that puncture, is called a black hole. This is a region of space-time that is so stretched, so distorted, that no light can escape from it. And we think of it as a hole in the fabric of space-time.
That doesn't sound good. I'm just thinking, okay, real, like, we've watched all of these TV shows and movies, and you know that space-time ripping is bad, right?
It sounds bad, but we're very safe here on Earth. The black holes like to stay where they are and mind their own business. So they're fascinating objects, a little bit scary when you first learn about them, but like many things in science, as Marie Curie said, just they're not to be feared, only to be understood.
Okay.
So we've done two concepts. We're working our way up to gravitational waves, which was the, you know, this is our selling point, right?
Yes.
We did the fabric sheet of space-time, and now we have these black holes, these rips in the fabric of space-time. And now finally we have what we need to make gravitational waves. If you have two black holes, two rips in the fabric of space-time, and you take them and you smash them together, this is a little bit like taking two bowling balls on your fabric sheet and smashing them together. What will happen? The answer is it's a little bit like taking a pebble and throwing it into the center of a pond. Uh-huh. Little waves or ripples emanate outward from the splash, and you'll see them spreading in a circular pattern outward as they get to the edge of the lake. The same thing happens when two black holes smash into each other. They make waves. But these waves aren't water waves, they're ripples in the very fabric of space-time itself. And these waves travel to us all the way at Earth, maybe 1.3 billion years later in some cases, and they cause tiny, almost unimaginably small stretching in the fabric of our space-time here on Earth. And I have a challenge now for our listeners, if I may.
Oh, yes. Please.
So if you're sitting, please stand up, and I'm going to have a gravitational wave come through you. Are you ready? Everyone standing?
Okay, we're standing.
All right. So everyone's standing up. I want you to stretch up as high as you can and suck in your tummies and put your head up as high as you can, and then slink back down, bulge yourself out at the middle, and put your arms out wide. That's what it's like to be stretched by a gravitational wave passing right through your tummy. It makes you first taller and a little bit skinnier, and then it stretches you the other way and it makes you slightly wider and shorter, and it oscillates back and forth, short and thin, tall and wider, short and thinner, taller and wider. And it does this, we think, all the time. These gravitational waves are passing through us, stretching us just very, very slightly, but they're so small, you can't tell that they're passing through you. You can't feel it. So what we need to do is make special instruments in order to detect these very small ripples in the fabric of space-time.
What do you need to know to operate a rover on Mars?
Oh, now I understand. It's about the rovers, the Mars rovers. Okay, tell us who our amazing guest is, Jeff.
That's right, Jennifer. Today we are talking to Brian Franz. He is a mechanical engineer working with some of the coolest people on the planet at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and he has worked directly on both the Mars Perseverance rover and currently the Mars Curiosity rover. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Welcome to the show, Brian. Yay!
Hello, Jennifer. Hello, Jeff. Thank you for having me. I'm super excited to be here.
Oh, we are super excited to have you. This is all about Mars. Jeff, you must be going crazy here.
I'm trying to hold myself in. Jennifer, I don't know if you're going to get any questions in edgewise, so I'll try to have to hold myself back.
Well, go right ahead.
Let's start with the basic question of Mars missions. That could mean any number of things right now. Brian, can you tell us specifically what you do?
Of course I can, Jeff. So I am a mechanical engineer, like you said, working in the Mars missions for NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. I specifically work on the Mars 2020 mission, the Perseverance rover that just landed. I helped test and design parts of that rover. And now I currently am also working on the surface operations, so analyzing the data coming back from the Curiosity mission, which was Perseverance's predecessor.
Well, that's so cool. And so the question that Brian is here to talk to us about is, what do you need to know to operate a rover on Mars? Now, I'm guessing this is not like a very simple answer, is it, Brian?
I would have to agree with that answer, that it's not simple in that sense.
Let's talk a little bit about Mars as compared to Earth. So if you go to Mars, what's it going to be like as compared to Earth?
You know, Jennifer, that's a great question because Mars is very different from Earth. One of the biggest differences is Mars is smaller than Earth. And what that causes is a lower gravity for things that are on the Martian surface. To be specific here, we are looking at a 38% difference in gravity, meaning that Mars has 38% of Earth's gravity.
Whoa, less than half.
Less than half.
All right.
So what does that mean if you're trying to operate something on the planet? Does it have to be heavier? I'm trying to figure this out. You understand engineering better than me.
Sure. So when we operate something on Mars, it actually becomes sort of a benefit if we're testing it on Earth first. Because when we're testing something on Earth, it actually weighs more than it will when it actually is on Mars, because the gravity is less. So the force required to do that operation is actually less.
Okay. So with the fact that human beings haven't been to Mars yet, and so far it's all been robots, have we run into any problems with the rovers in that reduced gravity?
Yeah, so the reduced gravity is one of the areas that we have experienced problems in. And one of the other areas is actually the very low reduced atmosphere. And we can go into that in a second. But I'll quickly mention that the gravity, actually, one of the things that it's caused is the surface dust on Mars actually kind of forms in different ways than it does on Earth, because the gravity pulling it towards the surface actually is different. So the way that it actually crumbles into little particles like sand are a very different structure than they would be on Earth. And they actually have caused more wear to our wheels on Mars than we initially expected.
Okay. I just have to say, you guys can't see Jeff and I, we're both sitting here with our mouths wide open. Like, this is the coolest thing we've ever heard.
Dust on Mars is different?
The dust on Mars, small shapes of the dust are different forms because the gravity is different and they haven't been either eroded in the same way or weathered in the same way or fallen down cliffs in the same way. And because of those different structures, it does cause differences in the wear on things that come into contact with it. In our case, our wheels.
And is that why the Perseverance rover's wheels were a much different design than the Curiosity rover wheels?
That is 100% correct, Jeff. Had to take into account that the wheels did not necessarily perform the way that they initially had expected, and corrections probably needed to be made. And so they took what they learned. And obviously, as engineers, we don't just rinse and repeat. We rinse and update and repeat.
That's a great way to put that.
Okay, so, but when did Curiosity go and when did Perseverance go? So like, how much time did you guys have to figure this out to change the different wheels out?
So Curiosity landed in early 2012, I believe.
Okay.
And I remember that because I was a junior in college and just all sorts of excited about that landing. And then obviously Perseverance landed just this past February. So there was this, I guess, simple arithmetic escapes me sometimes. I think that your listeners could probably do it better than I could right now. But I think that's about 8 years difference, 9 years difference in terms of the general landing periods. And so there was a little bit of time to operate and understand and learn and then, you know, apply what we've learned to the new rover.
Okay. So I have a question. So if you are on Mars,
How do you know that the tires are wearing differently?
So that comes from all the different cameras that we have on the rover. So every so often, there will be certain images that are taken from all different angles on the rover, wherever it can. And those images will be sent back to the respective teams that do the analysis, and they will determine, are we seeing differences? Are things the same? Do we need to do a different analysis? And they will go ahead and figure out what the best course of action is.
Well, of course, I loved listening to those snippets. But if you want to listen to the whole episode, Jennifer, where do they go?
Make sure you go to our website, solveitforkids.com, or anywhere you listen to the podcast. And guess what? We will be back next week with our brand new season, won't we, Jeff?
We will. So listen for us next week on Solve It for Kids.